All right, ladies and gentlemen, the time has come for Skips and myself to present for the first time the application of cracks of the world. So a crack of the world is technically something that breaks into the Moho and arguably is the Serpentosphere. And when you break this Serpentosphere, it releases brine that is carrying a universal hydrocarbon. And it is building a reservoir that we drill into millions and millions of years later. So it's a totally different perspective, but it's bound by the tools that we have established as geoscientists with structural geology, sedimentology, chemistry. It's bound by data and good science. And so right now we're going to take a quick break. And then we're gonna dive right into the presentation of applying a mud volcanic system to the Permian Basin. Could the Permian Basin have filled up with chemical muds via 400 plus mud volcanoes through geologic time? Is that what we're seeing in the data? And is that gonna make a difference for you and your next well that you're about to drill and how you're gonna complete it? I believe it is, and I'm super excited for this presentation. Again, feel free to obviously chime in, bring your questions. We wanna bring you on stage. We want to see you, we want to hear from you, and we wanna hear these progressive thoughts. So let's take a quick break and we'll go from there. Well done, Ronco. Ronco is saying I'm throwing $50 at the rock. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. It comes with the chromatograms, dude. It comes with exactly which hydrocarbons make up the chromatogram in this rock. It's incredible, and it looks just like the chromatogram of normal kerogen-rich rocks. There's Skippo. He's back.
We're back.
All right, man. Well, we'll just we'll wrap for a second about the auction and this rock. You know, the concept that just recently was really pushed forward and one that Magma Chem Research Institute has been talking about for many, many years, 30 years plus of that this the planet and kerogen specifically, it seems to be of a universal substance. But just recently, you know, the Mars and kerogen found on Mars. So we do have the concept and we have the data that says, you know what, this is a universal substance. So what models do we have today that allow us to apply that and put it in our models, in our approximation of reality and make decisions that better the company and better ourselves as professionals. And it's called the ultra deep hydrothermalism model that Magma Chem is pushing forward. So we won't get into that. We're going to talk about cracks to the world. Me and Skippo have worked on actually trying to present this.
I hope the audience is down to just go along with the ride with us. And then, like we were saying, just ask questions away. I'll keep looking at the chat and we'll be happy to answer anything.
Cool. And my job in this presentation is easy. I'm just talking about kind of the big relationships between it all and the fact that there is this concept of a plumbing system that is coming from as deep as 420 kilometers into the planet. So over 600 miles into our planet is the carbon cycle. So that is a very, very disruptive and very progressive concept for me and for Skips. And we're saying, okay, let's talk about it. Let's look at what Magma Chem has done for many, many years and try to make sense of this to better equip us with the tools to create value. So we're going to talk about that. Cracks of the world. Discussion PBE live, me and Skippo, and then you guys can obviously ask any questions along the way. So there is a relationship, and this is in 2003, Houston Geological Society, Magma Chem and the team had put this out there and said there seems to be between the global strike slip faults of the world, there seems to be a relationship with where we see giant resource accumulations. So if that's an empirical data point, then you must come with something that says, here's why that is. Here's how that could potentially be happening. We're talking about a plumbing system to the hydrocarbon generation on our planet. That's exactly where we're coming from and how this actually works. It's structurally controlled. So that's what makes it fun, because it's predictable. That's the most important thing about this. Our predictability in finding resources is going to drastically increase, and we are going to do this together. We're figuring it out literally right now. Here's a logical source of where you get high carriage and rich muds to fill up these basins that we drill into. And we can see those anomalies in the geologic record. There's a famous one in the Pennsylvanian time. A geologist out of the Permian Basin said, wow, I mean, the Pennsylvanian filled up with this huge amount of kerogen rich source rock in a short period of time. So we're going to talk about that. How is that possible? First, this is it. This is a 2003 and the work involved. Let me see if I can create a laser. Yep, there it is. So there should be a red laser running around. This is the plate tectonic equator. And this is all of the biggest cracks that you can map with a worldwide data set of GravMag that MagmaChem had access to through the relationships with all the operators they were working with. And they came up with these huge first order cracks. So we were talking about the way plate tectonics is moving and the relationship between the basins and the continents structurally. So that then provides a value to the conversation of a plumbing system. So I want to take a minute. This is potentially in MagmaChem's model of the UDH system, which is publicly available through MagmaChem Research Institute. This is an analog of the Permian Basin during approximately the Bone Spring time. So if you're cracking into the Serpentosphere, if you're cracking into the Moho and you're releasing these brines and you're creating this mud volcanic system at the surface of the earth during the time of deposition and these reservoirs that we're drilling into, this is a cartoon depiction of making that happen. Basement faults are penetrating the Moho. And for us, it's the Serpentosphere. So we're gonna this is the rock, and the bid is shot, and nobody bought it, and that's okay. It'll be up again. But based on Dickinson's work with K57.5 ratios on how to predict where this rock actually crystallized out in the planet based on depth, that's where this rock falls. It's approximately 420 kilometers into the planet. That's over 600 miles. This is a massive system. And our point here is that the system is predictable horizontally across the planet in scale. That's why we did the moon thing. That's why we came from the moon. The perspective from the moon, you're looking at the whole planet and the correlations of the whole planet, as well as this very large vertical relationship between how these reservoirs could potentially be putting themselves together through geologic time. So that rock is amazing. That's essentially the best source rock we got for type 2 oil. So back to cracks of the world, and then here's a zoomed in version. This is the diagram depiction of what the mud volcanic system, the Permian Basin, Delaware Basin side. So this is Central Basin Platform potentially, and this is not perfect. It's not designed for the Permian, but it's from the North Sea, and it's an analog that gets us kind of going about this idea that we have these big cracks. And so now we're going to get some audience participation. What in these three maps are familiar, are similar? What in these three maps in the Permian Basin stand out to everybody involved? We're going to throw out a gift card of $50, because that's what Ronco said for the rock auction. $50 gift card anywhere, anybody wants it. What's the relationship between these three photographs of shale production in the Permian Basin? That's the question. Skippo, you got anybody? I didn't really set them up too good. Let me go back to cracks of the world.
You did not. That was a very poor transition. But hey, I'll give it to you. So what? No, go back. You got to go back to the slide. You're asking.
All right.
Yeah.
There it is.
Rock it through.
Permian Basin. Here, the EIA. Here from...
Ronco says they're all picks from the U.S. Yes. He's not wrong.
That's true. Fuck. Does that mean we got to actually give that dude a freaking gift card? All right.
Well, he gets his money back.
The relationship is specifically when you're looking at the whole country, there's this tail in shale production. You see that tail right there? It happens again in this presentation, in this publication. They keep showing that there's this big linear feature that's coming out of the Permian Basin, specifically the Delaware Basin side, in Woodford Barnett production. So this is Woodford Barnett shale gas production. There's this line that's cracking off of the Permian Basin. So this is in approximately North 70 West line, and that's where Cracks of the World comes in. That's our tools that help us to understand how could this actually happen at the scale of a basin. So you take the planet, and we're now zooming into the basin, and there's something called the Texas Shear Zone. Skippo had it in his thesis. Skippo talked about this Texas Shear Zone. It's about North 70 West, big crack system, and it fits. It fits pretty well. North 70 West, big crack that goes from the Atlantic Ocean across the Gulf of Mexico and across the Permian Basin. That's the Texas Shear Zone. So that's what caught our attention. We go, whoa, 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 whoa. That's an interesting correlation. So why would the crack of the world, this idea that the plumbing system of the Permian Basin be coming off of this big North 70 West feature called the Texas Shear Zone? So here's diving in a little bit further. Western side of the Delaware Bay, of the Central Basin Platform. That's what this blue line is. The western side of the of the Central Basin Platform. Why are we talking about the Central Basin Platform? That's because it's the biggest crack, arguably, in the Permian Basin. So the west side of the Central Basin Platform that has the anomaly in it, that has thousands and thousands of feet of dolomite. Where did all the magnesium come from? Could it have come from a brine charge system under the Permian Basin, cracking into the Moho, releasing the brine system to the surface and allowing that kind of dolomitization to happen in the Permian Basin? We absolutely think that that is true. So here's Cracks of the World. Here's North 70 West feature. This is crude. The Cracks of the World was done at a scale from the moon. So this is not incredibly accurate, but it doesn't take much of an imagination to take this big crack that has been geologically decided by geologists and geophysicists sitting in the same room, said this is a big crack based on GravMag that's hooking up to the North 70 West feature. And if you just move that crack slightly, it kind of represents the west side of the Central Basin Platform. So there are some anomalies here that me and Skips are like, dude, we got to talk about this. We have to engage in the conversation of a plumbing system that's way bigger than the vertical scale we're usually used to, and a place that we can provide solutions to some of these anomalies that we see. So that's it. The West, and you guys all know better than we do, the actual anatomy of the structural relationship of this huge fracture that's going on the west side of the Central Basin Platform is very, very complex. It is not simple, but this allows us a foundation to start with some very sound interpretations to start finding out what is going on in the mud volcanic systems around the world right now. So what we're highlighting here is the Caspian Sea. Specifically, we're gonna dive into the southern part of the Caspian Sea. You see this big fracture, North 70 West-ish, just like this one. The Caspian Sea has over 400 mud volcanoes. It's a massive hydrocarbon generation process happening on the planet right now. So can we use this area as an analog to allow us to think of new sources of sediment for the Permian Basin to fill up with? That's why we thought we got to talk about mud volcanism. So here's a geologic map. You're looking at anticline symbols. You're looking at this big system that's kind of wrenching into this fault here. So from the South Caspian Sea, the structure seems to have some kind of relationship that's wrenching here, and then it builds a line across these anticlines, right across this part of the Caspian Sea. So what's going on there? What's this structural relationship that clearly has something to do with all these mud volcanoes? The same structural relationship that's wrenching into this North 70 West feature and across the top of this big crack that's going through the Caspian Sea. It's generating mud, it's bringing up kerogen, and it has light oil. It has all these things that would really help us in the sense of filling up a basin with chemical muds that are rich in kerogen. So here's the cross section of the Caspian Sea. We got a plume, essentially, that's being interpreted on seismic. It's very distorted. It doesn't read well. That could be an energy plume that's happening in the Caspian Sea and a source of sediment via mud volcanism. What's interesting, though, about this and using the Caspian Sea as an analog for the Permian Basin, and I'll stop here in a minute and let Skips finish it with some geochem, is how fast this thing filled up with kerogen-rich muds. And so when the anomalies in literature from 100 years ago, literally, I mean, we're talking P.B. King, the guy, the Delaware guy and his friends were talking about how, man, the Permian Basin filled up pretty dang quick. They had that observation. And we also have, and Skip's going to talk about this, the observation of where did it come from? Where's the provenance of this chemical mud? Where is this shale coming from? So this filled up in 12 million years, approximately 10 kilometers. I mean, these things are pumping. We potentially could be looking at a really old system that is like this in the Permian Basin. So and the Anadarko Basin. I think that's the third time I said that, Brian Bottoms. The Anadarko Basin could be absolutely the same thing. Are we looking for a source of energy, not a source of sediment? Look at it as a source of energy. And now map using the geochemical tools we have, the structural control of geology. Thank God for Steno and all the giants that have helped us build our ideas and these fundamental ideas of geology. We're using those tools and it is controlling how the kinematics and how the fluid and these chemical muds are putting themselves together. So it's not just another idea. No, this is an idea that has a direct implication of where you're going to put your wellbore and why, without question. So to further that, this is kind of a cartoon schematic of basically what the anatomy of a mud volcano would look like. You have a conduit, you have this thing around it that's very interesting geochemically, and it creates a plume. It creates an energy release, a reservoir release, if you will, during the time of deposition, in a specific direction that's going to be structurally driven, and in that plume creates the anatomy of how we actually break down our reservoirs. That's how these silts and these high productive zones that seem to be spotty all over the place are being controlled. That's what we're putting out there. This is a modern analog of a big area under major structural constraint. And there's mud volcanism coming all around and up from the deep. It's pumping up a bunch of mud in this big structurally controlled void. So through geologic time and how we look at seismic data and how we look at the features that we're actually drilling into, when you start putting together this connection of to the plumbing system and these deep features that could be driving the mud fill in our reservoirs and in the sweet spots that we're looking for, the high productive zones of the unconventional shale, this is the context we need to be thinking in. It's a bottom to top type thing. It's a deep to seep, as Magma Chem has developed the terminology of. And when you look at the seismic, it's strikingly similar. It just is. Imagine your seismic in the Permian or the Anadarko Basin as a bunch of mud volcanoes all over the place that are structurally driven. Fluids are coming up these conduits of structure control. And then it's 300 million years later, right? It's 200 million years later. Go ahead, Skips.
Brian has a comment. He says, the Anadarko Basin fault nearly parallels the same fault trend in the Delaware and is well-known strike slip example. Definitely an interesting correlation.
Dude, all right, last slide for me. And Skippo is going to show some geochemical analysis and this relationship that we have the tools. You already have the data. It's just putting it in to a different form and into a different model to make sure that you're making the right predictions. So to end it for me, we need to go out and we need to find these mud volcanic systems. We need to find these conduits of this mud volcanism system, and we could potentially have 400 plus new locations in the Permian Basin that are prime and ready, built by Mother Nature to generate as much hydrocarbon as possible. That's where we need to be. It's not blanket hydro. It's not fracking across the horizon. These things change rapidly through temperature and pressure changes during the time of deposition. You got to find the source. We're mapping our way back to the energy source of these plumes. That's where we land our well bores. That's where we treat this system. And that's what's going to generate hydrocarbon for more than enough years for all of us to have and for the generations to come. Skippo, can I pass it to you?
What? 1 second. Neil has a question. And
Neil Turlick?
Neil Turlick, man. He's been killing it in the chat, dude.
Oh,
he's
dude.
He's an animal. And he asks, how does it relate to the Mid-Con Rift?
How does the
cracks of the world system relate to the Mid-Con Rift? Because we know almost perpendicular to what we're seeing in cracks of the world, right? The Mid-Con Rift is more of a north-northeast.
That's it right there. You guys see that on the screen? That's the Mid-Continent Rift that comes right down into the Nemaha Ridge in Oklahoma. This thing that's coming out of the Great Basin, out of Neil Turlick's backyard right now. It's coming out of this thing. Now, this thing's like a 2.5 billion year old feature or something. It's very old, but it is 1.2 billion years old. It's very old, and it has a lot to say with how the structure through geologic time and how these fluids are moving through geologic time structurally in the Anadarko, in Kansas, and arguably it comes right through the Permian Basin. That's why the similarities between the Anadarko and the Permian are there. This Mid-Continent Rift ends up coming right into what's called the Nakazari Slab Tear. That's what this dashed line is. This dashed line is a huge slab tear, and it's releasing and helping this system generate what we call a world-class reservoir, the Permian Basin. The Mid-Continent Rift comes right into it. It's overprinted by probably five other major geologic processes, but it is there. You can see the remnants of it. Skips did it in his thesis. Skip, oh, you want to talk about the Abilene gravity minimum? That's part of potentially what is the Mid-Continent Rift.
Or the slab tear. The slab tear.
They're together, right? This scale, it's part of... Right, the rift is here, but it does have some kind of implication eventually down into the slab tear, which goes right across the Abilene gravity minimum. So there is some relationship there of where this ends and the Nakazari slab tear begins.
Ooh, Molly, at some point we'll try to make the dream work and get you on here. She wants to She wants to attempt to speak about the Wichita uplift. And do you want to hop on right now, Molly? Is that a thumbs up?
Ask her. Wow, what's up, Molly?
Hi.
What's going on?
Okay. Likewise, thank you guys. Thank you so much for staying in tune, and I can't wait to hear what your thoughts are on these observations. Just real quick, will you allow us to just be entertained by your career? Just a quick synopsis of that.
Sure. So I've always loved Oklahoma structural geology. I went to University of Tulsa, got a bachelor's, a master's, got a job with Chesapeake, hated working in the oil and gas industry, always wanted to be a professor. So I went back to OU to get a PhD so I could teach. That was 9 years ago. I finally just graduated, but I still work at Chesapeake. Now I love working in industry, and I don't know if I'll ever teach, but Oklahoma geology has been a passion, structural geology. I did my dissertation on the Wichita uplift. I did my master's on the Ardmore Basin. So I could talk about Oklahoma geology for hours.
Wow. I mean, What's your observation as far as, you know, we're kind of crude and more focused on the Permian, but it's very interesting to see this tie to the Anadarko Basin. That's how big this scale is, and it has an effect across basins.
Oh, yeah. There's a great paper by Ryan Leary. I don't know if you know him. I think he's out of Arizona. And he looks at, like, late Pennsylvanian Permian tectonics. So traditionally, we think of the collision between North America and South America happening on the East Coast and wrapping around. And right. That was the cause for, like, the ancestral Rockies, the Wichita uplift, even some of the tectonics in the Permian. But what he's proposing based on some of his research is that we had almost this like left lateral transpression shear zone along the southwest coast of the United States during the Permian, the Penn to Permian. And what we're proposing is that that was actually responsible for the Wichita uplift.
Wow.
So my dissertation used a lot of like 2D and 3D seismic. So we really nailed down the timing. And what we saw was a change in the structural styles that would implicate pre-existing faults from the Precambrian to Cambrian rift,
wow.
which were generally northeast or northwest, southeast. And then as those became reactivated, depending on the orientation of those faults with your paleostress directions, determined whether you had like compression folding versus more strike slip. So by understanding the structural style and the timing, you really get a really good understanding of your paleo stresses responsible for those structures.
Wow, Molly, that was awesome. It's the difference between compression in areas and tension. Where are you going to have mud volcanism? In tension. You got to map our way to the tension, and it's happening through strike slip. Just, I mean, that you're looking at this big scale with the Wichita Albany what do you call it, orogeny, that's happening there. You're looking at that scale. It's happening at the reservoir scale too, and in these horizons we're getting this tension and we're getting compression. Stay away from compression, find yourself in some tension, and let's stimulate some freaking reservoir.
Yes, absolutely. And along the Wichita uplift in the Anadarko Basin, there's this controversial Ouachita Valley fault. And in an upcoming publication, we show that we did have transtension along that fault to create these pull-aparts. So we definitely had that deep-seated link down to those rift faults from the Precambrian. We definitely had transtension on those during the Virgilian, which is right before the Permian.
Wow.
So I feel like it's all linked.
It is. You're spot freaking on. It's without question. So how do we follow your development in those papers and how do we do this? We want to drive people to those answers, because you're talking about the structural relationship of how and why these reservoirs are driving the way they are. That's very, very important.
Yeah, so my dissertation's out there. One of my goals was to kind of release data. So there's a lot of seismic data out there. And then, of course, you have my interpretations, conclusions. We're trying to get a few papers published, but as you know, that takes time.
Right.
You know, I'll post on LinkedIn. Since a lot of that is still proprietary, I don't feel comfortable speaking too much about it, like showing images.
Yeah.
But it's all in my dissertation, and I can speak to that. So,
wow, Skippo, what do you got, dude? She's talking structure, dude, man. That's your language.
Badass, man. I was gonna say, it's Len, because you have all that 2D and 3D, and you hinted on the most, in my opinion, the most important part of structural geology, which is timing. Understanding the timing of the different events is what is going to basically, you know, for a petroleum geologist, understand how that fluid is going to move, right? Where you have these areas of transpression and where you can potentially create different trapping elements, and areas where you have transtension, where, you know, that's where the fluids can migrate to and then into maybe a low pressure sand or something like that, right? So that's where I, you know, harken back to Bilodeau, structure drives everything. That's the MO.
Wow. Molly, thank you so much for joining us on this. That was incredibly valuable, and I can't wait just as much as you can publish. And obviously I follow you on LinkedIn. I'm always trying to comment where I can. And it's always interesting what you got going on, and please just keep that going. We need that. It's time for people to get excited about geology again.
All right. Will do. Thank you, guys.
Right on. See ya.
Yeah, Molly.
So what else we got, Skips, as far – you want to switch over to your GeoChem?
Yeah, we'll do a quick and dirty little dive, and then I'll just kind of give the people my thoughts on the matter. A couple things that I like to do in my free time include fishing, lifting heavy, and reading a lot of papers about structural geology. And if you read a lot of papers in the journals of structural geology, specifically out of the Mediterranean, the Caspian, and the Black Sea, mud volcanism is a very common thread through these massive shear zones. So this fault that trends right through the north of the Black Sea, between there and the Sea of Azov, is the same exact fault that trends through the Caspian, to put that in perspective, all right? So we're going to zoom into the Kerch Peninsula, and this is where there are active mud volcanoes on the surface that are coming out of one of these zones where we're getting transtension. And it's always been interesting to me, because in depositional models for shales, you never hear anything about mud volcanism, right? It's always this high sand systems tract, and we have this time of just kind of quietness. We have clay flocculating, settling, this organic matter that's just dropping out. You have an anoxic environment, hopefully, and it's preserved. And mud volcanism is never talked about in these things. And kind of one of my, I'd say one of the joys of working at, you know, our old employer, is we got to look at a ton of data. And I mean an ungodly amount of data. And luckily, I got to evaluate the Woodford in just about every corner of the Permian, from the Eastern Shelf to Andrews County to Winkler County to East Pecos to the Southern Delaware to the Alpine High, all the way up to Culberson County. And there was always one thing that kind of stood out to me, and that was that the Woodford has things that it would follow in the depositional models established by Comer within the Permian. But then there were a lot of things when you dove into the data that made absolutely no sense. When you tried to apply that model, you were seeing clays and you were seeing enrichment in specific elements, especially near faults, that just didn't quite make sense. You had this mud rock that drastically changed the closer and more proximal you got to these massive shear zones. So with that kind of backstory, we're diving in, we're looking at these different mud volcanoes on the peninsula. And what they did is they took samples from the Mayakop Shale, which is a proximal source rock to these mud volcanoes. They took fresh muds from these mud volcanoes, and they took weathered muds from these mud volcanoes. The Mayakop is Miocene in age. It is prolific for producing gas hydrite, so dry gas, NGLs, and some light oil. So I felt like this was a pretty good analog for what we were seeing on the Woodford in Southern Pecos, or in the Southern Delaware Alpine High area. So from there, they took these samples and they did mass spec on them. And you're going to see some very alarming correlations between the shale, which is Miocene in age, and these fresh muds that are coming out of the mud volcanoes on the surface of the earth as we speak. And sound the alarm. And one thing, when they pulled out these fresh muds, is, you know, the main constituents that they were seeing were, you know, these different pygrite aggregates, from nodules to all these like various other shapes and sizes to just fragments. And then they were seeing amorphous kerogen. So if you are familiar with SOM, amorphous kerogen is a kerogen structure that's typically referred to as when kerogen is put under a lot of heat and pressure and that structure begins to break down, or where I'm more in the realm of thinking is associated with mud volcanism. When I see amorphous kerogen, I think of mud volcanism. So if you go to the next slide. All right, so now we're going to bring it back to the Permian, because, you know, keeping things in perspective. And this is a well. The Star is kind of an extremely crude location of the well. So then we'll skip to the next slide. And so what I've done here is I've taken out the Mayakop, and I've replaced the mass spec data from the Woodford taken out of the core in that well from the black shale lithofaces. So as we're approaching this fault that's bounding the Alpine High, right? So that western margin of the Central Basin Platform, that North 70 West Texas lineament, we start to see crazy similarities between what we would expect from the mud volcano and what we see in the Woodford Shale. We see The big difference that you see between the two is you see chert and phosphate nodules within the Woodford, but you see this abundance again of amorphous kerogen. And then what we see is, as our like primary trace elements are concerned, is they match up pretty, I'd say it's a pretty solid match, right? And yeah. When you're looking, and this is the thing I'm trying to get at, and this will be my last point on this slide, is when you're looking at a shale, there is a very easy way to tell if it is detrital or if it's a potential mud volcano. And the difference between those two and the way you exploit those different resources is that's where you can get into trouble. Because if you're something associated more with mud volcanism, you're going to get more smectite potentially, right? Especially on the fringes of those mud volcanoes where you're getting more monmorillonite and these other swelling clays. Low so energy, those are the, yeah, those are the things that can, those are going to be your thief zones, right? Where when you're pumping water in, those clays are going to swell and they're just going to stop that porosity and permeability, right? And plug you up there. So
yeah.
It's just another perspective to explain the heterogeneity of what you see in these black shales, because as you know, they change constantly and there's so many different interpretations for what you see, right. But this one for me seemed the most consistent.
No, that was solid. I think that was interesting to see that at the geochemical level, at the elemental level, you can see these relationships. And if you're just mapping this chemical change in the elements away from these high energy zones, and you have the data that shows high energy to low energy from a mud volcanism perspective, you can see it in the geochem. You got the cuttings, you got the data in the wells you're drilling. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So I hope everyone enjoyed our rant. It was a little bit of a freestyle. We're down to answer some questions. I didn't even look at the chat.
Let's just talk about it. Absolutely. Yeah. Talk about it.
Cracks of the world, mud volcanoes,
yep.
Whatever have you. We're game.
There's a lot to it, man. And it's not a silver bullet by any means. Next month, we're talking about actually taking on the geologic challenge of integrating between sedimentary rocks and igneous rocks. The process of rock formation is a lot more complex than we think. However, when you got the UDH model, it makes it simpler. So we're blurring those lines because we're jumping into the mining industry. So
here comes Neil coming in hot.
No, is that him? Is he locked and loaded or is he shooting guns?
Dude, I think he's pretty loaded. Neil's always loaded. I saw that video. He says, how analogous is the Mediterranean to the Permian depositional environment? Not Caspian, but Mediterranean.
We can hear you. We just can't see you, Neil.
Oh, my God. Yeah, talk about coming in hot. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday.
Happy motherfucking hump day, dude.
Let's go.
That's
right, man.
Dude, all right. Yeah, Neil, dive into it.
I've had this thought process that the Mediterranean today is what the Permian was yesterday, and that the mud volcano thing to me is still a little different. You know, I'm so classically trained as a sedimentologist that the influx of sediment from two different continents into a what could be a very growing to be starved basin via water, not sediment load, could be analogous to the Permian.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely analogous in this. It's all about the time, right? So like if you're talking similar to maybe Devonian actually, no, it'd be more Penn. Penn, it would be the exact time that you're talking about, right? Because you now have these two continents coming in with the Marathon of Ouachita. You're shedding into the same area. But I'd say the Med is a very analogous representation of the Permian from the Pennsylvanian time period.
I've never shared this with anyone before, so don't tell anyone.
Okay.
Hey, dude. Your
no promises, but you're live.
Your thoughts are spot on, dude. Don't hesitate to bring that up in conversation at all, ever.
But then with that, so what surrounds the entire Mediterranean? A bunch of volcanoes. So is there heat influx from, you know, all the different rift systems, all the great structural geology that's happening there that is then creating heat to cook and make sediment into mud volcano.
Ah, so you're coming at it from the idea that the heat at the low, at the depths at which the mud's being generated, you're saying that heat is creating the reaction for hydrocarbon. Is that what you're going getting at?
Yep, that's pretty much what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think that that allows the oil generation window story to happen at near surface in these mud volcano systems.
And run it into the Rio Grande Rift into West Texas and compare that to the Pennsylvanian age sands that were cooked like 30 million years ago. Because all the rock throughout that area has been influenced
by the volcanics.
By the volcanics. There's so many volcanics in the Alpine High. It's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Dikes.
Yeah, that's a good thought.
Yeah. So that's what I think about when I'm mudlogging in the Permian.
Yeah, you're still talking about the... Right. You're still talking about a much later event that has an effect on the much older sediments that are down in the basin.
Which has nothing to do with the mud volcano theory, but...
Right. You're using the temperature thing. So rocks
classical
are...
Classical thinking. Forgive me.
Classical thinking, traditional thinking, not to be offensive, obviously. But let's think about... Let's think about, Neil, let's think about how good rocks are at transferring heat. So you can have this big-ass volcano, and rocks are terrible at transferring heat. So what we're talking about is that at the time of deposition, it's very hot, it's filled with brine, it's filled with kerogen, and it is generating hydrocarbon at the time of deposition, which there are presentations and publications that have done rhenium osmium dating in the Delaware Basin and in the Anadarko with the Woodford. They have aged the rock. They've aged the rock, and rhenium osmium also has aged the reservoir. And the reservoir and the rock is the same age. So how does that happen? What's going on with that anomaly? So I think... You've got something going on as far as close proximity to the volcanoes in and around the Delaware Basin, but we got to get back to the time of deposition via mud volcano, I think, and that's going to drive the reservoir response in these things.
I like it. It's a fresh idea.
Fresh idea, man.
And it's not, like you said, it's not to spoil conventional thinking. It's just something to put into why you're seeing anomalies within your data. Right?
Yeah. A legendary argument is the heat influx from the recent volcanics in the Delaware Basin. That's without question a modern argument amongst geoscientists, for sure. And I just tend to be on the side that says it has an effect if you get really right up on it. But if I'm out like Cimarex sitting on the west side of the Delaware Basin or the Alpine High, I'm definitely looking at this from the mud volcanics model. Neil, dude, Michigan Basin, Neil, we still need to do that, man. I promised you we would talk about it and start attacking it from this kind of perspective. That big hole up there that you got wells and you're out there gunslinging at the wellheads on, dude. There is some serious potential up there to make great money in the near future. I believe that.
Yeah, I've been getting myself in a lot of trouble up here. So look out. Wild, wild east.
All right, brother.
All right. And then we got a really good dude, Brian Bottoms, just absolutely crushing it. He said lots of talk about hydrothermal mineralization literature. About black smokers being the source of the metals that you see.
Right. Source of the metals that we see in the reservoir? Is that the question?
Is that kind of the what you're hinting at there, Brian? So the source of kind of like those anomalous metals that we're seeing? So more so is the ores themselves. Gotcha. Brian, you want to just come on?
Is he coming on? Talk about black smokers and white smokers. It's about to get weird, dude, because we're talking the generation of life and all kinds of things.
All right, let's bring Brian back on. Let's bring Brian back on.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You removed Skips from the room.
Oh, what happened?
I don't know. He's back.
I'm here. I'm here in spirit.
Yeah, I think it's overall, it's a very interesting theory and something I mean, would like to look into a lot in terms of, you know, as you guys might remember, my research was focused on, you know, where does the metal come from in these ores that we find that are kind of like on the flanks of these basins, and they occur right where these black shales like pinch out against the carbonate margin. And I was trying to find, you know, what is the source of the metal? And a lot of speculation is that source of the metal is from the shales themselves. As you showed, Skips, you know, these shales are a sink for metals. But I mean, there's a lot of talk in the literature about, you know, people speculating on what the source is and if that is, you know, black smokers in the ocean themselves, or does it come from basement rocks and hydrothermal fluids leaching it from the basement rocks there? I don't know. I think it's still a lot of unknowns.
Dude, yeah. Listen.
And I think that's actually a really solid point, because Dr. Grammer has done a large amount of work with that as well from the Oklahoma State in regards to these hydrothermal dolomites. And those, except like you said, those metals that they're seeing enrichment in those dolomites, and they're coming from that basement rock, and they have the data to prove that, and that is spot on, I think.
Yeah, I so interestingly enough, the Woodford sits right on a dolomite there in North Arkansas, and the sample that I had that matched the signature of the ores the most was from the lowermost Woodford that sits right atop that dolomite. So interesting perspective there too.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, did the metals in the dolomites come from the shales? Did the either way, I guess, you know, they're close proximity of both.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's kind of what we were getting at, was because when you're looking at the provenance for the Woodford of both like the Anadarko, like you're saying, or the Delaware Basin, right? When you're looking at that ancestral Rockies, or the Perdural Massif, as they were calling it, right? Like even those, using those as like your source rocks, you're not going to get enrichment with those metals in those black shales in the quantities that you see them. It's just, it makes no sense. So there needs to be another interpretation of that.
Yeah. I kind of think a lot of it is, you know, just the reducing environment that is prevalent in the you know, depositional time of those black shales. And then that you basically precipitate out reduced metals that they want to bond. So iron sulfide, you know, pyrite being one, but the same thing with, you know, zinc and lead. So. Mm-hmm.
Brian Bottoms, you've officially tapped us out, at least for me. I would love to absolutely banter with you about this concept of integrating black smokers and white smokers to time of deposition and to how hydrocarbon generation and reservoirs are being made. That is happening, man. And this is for everybody involved. That is happening in the UDH course that MagmaChem is publicly putting out. It is the course that integrates it all at a much, much, much bigger scale. And it really opens up our minds to how could this be possible outside of really our current limitations intellectually, man.
Thanks for putting it on today, for sure. I always enjoy you guys. So just keep it up, man.
Yeah.
Appreciate
like,
it, Brian.
Like we were saying, everyone who's still on board right now, we want to just say from the bottom of our hearts, thank you. Because this, we were just trying to think of something creative, something to break out of the normalcy of, you know, what we're doing, even though I guess this is kind of now the new normal. But yeah. I mean, trying to put up a different format, seeing how it worked out, and we really appreciate the involvement from everyone who's still here.
No question about it, man. Yeah. And we'll do it again in August. It's going to be a mining sort of a focused deal, but it's going to be just as impactful, just as powerful geologically. And the business of lithium being the new oil, that's the guy we're bringing on the show, and how this is actually happening. How do you find lithium? Let's talk about that. And we will. So next month, we'll see you guys all again. I think that's it, Skippo. Am I right or am I right?
I think we're good.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We out.